9 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland, and John, we still miss you. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Cherie Blackfeather hosts the KBOO Report with more on KBOO and community radio throughout the world. At 9:30, Chris Andre hosts a special news report, and at 10 p.m., Per Fegren hosts a show on Syria, Lebanon, and the assassinations. At 10:30, Pat McGuire hosts a special holiday Boneheads and Bigots show with a mystery musical guest. And 11, it's Democracy Now! Coming up, the KBOO Report.
Cherie Blackfeather was inspired by conversations with other KBOO members at the station to invite several of them to participate in a discussion about community and the commons. This radio piece is titled The Meme, produced by Cherie Blackfeather in collaboration with Peter Toby. Special thanks to Steve Lindenmeyer, Ricky Franks, Peter Toby, and Wiley G. Barnett, who participated in the discussion.
There's a lot of words that get used a lot and don't get examined very much. Community and the commons, both words that get used an awful lot and not necessarily thought about a lot.
When I first came to Portland, I would hear people refer to the black community, for instance. People had a hard time expanding that from just a geographical meaning to a meaning that had to do with people who identified with certain kind of ways of living, certain kind of lifestyle, certain kind of opportunities or oppressions. And gradually people that I was associated with began to understand that you could consider yourself a part of the black community even if you lived a good ways out of Northeast Portland.
about the geographic concept of black community or the geographic concept of culture or diversity or anything, that there is more than one approach, more than one meaning. That's why it's important to discuss.
Right.
What I heard you say, geographic, my mind went straight to historical.
And then there's intentional community, and there's the powers that draw people together and define them as working in common, because after all, community means having something shared in common. To the extent that it's conscious, is a chosen thing, mm-hmm. and an intentional. How do you see yourself as part of a community, and how do you then intentionally, consciously participate and reinforce, create, in fact, and sustain that sense of community?
Mm-hmm. I think there's a question that's like right before the ones you just laid out. It's how do you define community? And then the list of what you just said, individually, how do you define it? Mm-hmm. I think that's really important to think about.
Well, that makes me think of the Zapatista movement, you know, where they all sit around together to discuss something, and they'll discuss it, and everybody has a voice, and they'll discuss it and make sure everybody has been allowed to weigh in on something, and they're deciding something that's going to impact their community. And how important that is, because you're basically asking each one that very question.
I wanted them to define neighborhood, and what was the difference between neighborhood and community. Because in the literature, the social literature anyway, there's a big argument between what is a community and what is a neighborhood. And striking things I found was, particularly one statement in this interview, we said, community is everyone you meet. And other people were like, this doesn't even feel like a neighborhood. You know, so it's a personal thing.
Contrary to the way America has been structured, there have been many sustainable societies that lived for thousands of years, and they were sustainable on multiple levels. For instance, they had their own form of feeding themselves, their own form of agriculture, their own form of fishing and farming and so forth. And even among American Indians and many of the African tribes were conscious of the need to respect the earth so that they would only use what they needed. In other words, they didn't go into mass killings of animals, but they would take just as much as they needed, and even in the taking would respect the spirit of the animal, recognizing that it wasn't an unending resource.
The dominant paradigm of the corporate capitalism, where their values are all towards profit and growth, you lose the whole value or understanding of the terms of sustainability and diversity. We've lost the cultural heritage, and we're dominated by a different set of cultural values. You have to re-seize the present in order to create that future, and you have to redefine those terms and regain your historical perspective.
We're not really creating something new. We're trying to reassert.
Or reclaim.
And reclaim. When you use the phrase common sense, when people say, what's wrong with you? You don't have any common sense? Where those values used to be common, and when somebody acted outside that, you'd just shake your head. Global corporations abhor diversity because, for them, it is a source of inefficiency, uncertainty, and most of all, a drain on profits. This is what really jumped out at me when I was reading this. They seek to reduce costs and increase market control through cultural homogenization, economic specialization, and elimination of unprofitable species.
The earliest settlers in America, as they began to evolve colonies and so forth, considered Native Americans unprofitable species because they couldn't enslave them to the extent that they wanted to, mm-hmm. to be the fodder for the commercial engines that they had in mind. So they considered them unprofitable species. But even that's true today. If you look at the number, just the sheer number of people that are in prisons all across the country. In a way, it's like the government or the governing authorities or the corporate mentors saying, these are unprofitable, warehouse them, we don't need them.
Of course, we're really talking not just about the United States, but North America, South America, Africa, Australia. All of these regions have been overwhelmed by this culture of profit and growth, displacing the cultures that were sustainable.
I'd like to point out that there are still cultures that exist like that in the world, and they are being colonized, or the attempts to destroy those cultures now, too. These historical examples are important because there are people who are descendants of that legacy. Well, we all are, really. And it really doesn't matter what color you are or what tribe you come from, because we all inherited that. We all inherit that history. But it's still going on. It's not something that happened a long time ago, and it just has continued. It never stopped, and it continues right now.
And that is, I think, part of our challenge. It has to stop eventually. Eventually, this value of profit and growth will consume everything. And then where is its future? Where do we go from there? All the resources have been used. The diversity has been eliminated. How do you regrow a planet we can live on? Because all of those sustainable cultures are being eliminated, are being imperialized, colonized.
One of the big questions is, do we need to maintain capitalism? Do we need to have a profit system? And if we change our way of life, what is that going to look like? How do we convince people to give up their SUVs or even their you know, fuel efficient, whatever? But I think I started to hear you try to integrate how we uphold, like, the common heritage and improve the system, I suppose. Because that's a striking question. If we're concerned about the commons, what do you mean by that? What do we mean by that? Does that mean I have to individually give up something? Aren't I entitled to the so-called American dream?
The expectation of perpetual growth forever, always having a profit. This is a closed system, essentially. We're on a planet with a limited supply of air and resources and water, and you can't just always expect 2 or 3 or 5 or 20% profit forever and ever within the same closed system. So getting back to the values of sustainability, I think, is a crucial educational change in which we reorient all our values to accept that some of the things we currently hold as personal and private need to be held in common with the vision towards sustainability.
Looking at this really long-term, historically, it seems to me that, in a way, socially, we've been giving up an awful lot for an awful long time. The sustainable idea means that there's a limit, that you don't grow forever. Sustainable cultures, to my mind, were those cultures which found a way to maintain a balance between their numbers and the resources that they had available. They stayed geographically in one place. They learned how to adapt. They lived within that. And there was a lot less sense of personal ownership. In fact, the idea of commons, sort of the elitist almost notion of the commons, it assumes a certain sort of dominion, human dominion over all of these things. The whole idea of personal property, private property, is something we've given up, huge common holdings to have that. Now we sort of cling preciously to this idea that this is mine and it's not yours, and there's a separation. But that separation has kind of been imposed over a long time, to where now we feel like it would be a loss to go back. In a way, it's kind of backwards. we've really given up a lot in terms of commons. And I think at this point, collectively, we're starting to see that that commons is going to come back and bite us. We are a closed system. We live on a planet. In a sense, all of it is the commons.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And if we don't start to see that, it's going to say, hey, well, I'm going to reassert myself because I am that thing that you've given up.
I'm thinking about the image of America on a global scale. How do we reassert our notions of the commons and sharing and deprivatizing a lot of things and maintain this all-powerful nation look, at least economic, militaristic, whatever, however it is that we, and I'm speaking big here, have this America. You know, America's the most powerful, economic, the most free, the most that. How do we keep that the most, and which I think is a very important image for this country?
What you're almost talking about is nationalism. Nationalism is basically an anathema to the commons. It's the concept that there are isolated individual groups, and some of them have dominance and control over resources and regions. Commons breaks that idea down, where we're realizing that we're all members of the same living system, the Earth. We have to let go of this concept of the United States is supposed to be this world superpower that's somehow entitled to control these resources and these living cultures of the other people of the planet.
I see what you're saying, and I see this side of me, the impossibility, unless, of course, we wipe out this country. Well, I mean, we went to war to spread democracy. We were all for, let's spread democracy, and I'm saying we loosely here. He got reelected on this, we're going to spread democracy. Business.
You know,
yes, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
American supremacy.
As the opposite to the commons.
The commons. But it's really supremacy. That's what we have to give up. If we're going to give up something, it's this notion of supremacy.
I think a lot of this kind of like the feeling of needing to be superior, the feeling of needing to be in control, oftentimes that comes ultimately out of a sense of insecurity, a deep insecurity.
I agree.
And I think that often comes from a disconnect from maybe it's the commons. Maybe that comes from that initial sense of loss, of a deep security. And so the seeking after a superiority that makes one feel in control or masks that deep insecurity is where that comes from.
I go back to the concept of supremacy because I find that that lingers, it clings so tightly, like even in the environmentalist movement. I mean, anything that sort of originates in the developed countries, there's this supremacist attitude, like we have the solution. And I saw that at the grassroots radio conference, I think, when we were trying to figure out how to talk to each other, and that there were a group of people that suggested that these models we were using were not working for us and that we try something more indigenous. A lot of people didn't know what that means. We carry all this supremacy around with us, like, well, what could those people possibly have to teach us?
Human beings sort of uniquely have this facility for spreading ideas, for having ideas and spreading ideas, the notion of memes. A meme is like a virus of the mind. It can be thought of as an entity. It's an idea that has the power to spread itself. You're talking about trying to use an indigenous model for development of ideas. That's, I think, a very specific example where ideas have been used to negate values. There have been very conscious things like indigenous peoples have been castigated in a way. There have been ideas floated out there by people who want to be in power that indigenous ways are somehow inferior, that they should be dismissed, that there are better ways, that, you know, we can move on. This is a form of thought control, which is really pervasive. This is a critical part of a commons that people don't necessarily think about. The commons that we hold as ideas. I think it's growing generally in the awareness around the world that if we're going to move forward, we're going to have to do it collectively. We don't really have any choice. And not only don't we have any choice, but it's a way more powerful way to act and be. But I think this is an important commons that we need to be aware of and make use of.
Every time I've been hearing this, it makes me smile inside because our whole constitution came from the Iroquois Nation.
Exactly.
Right. So it's just, how do we forget that?
I think there is a meme, an active thought virus going on, you know, because actually people are resisting all over the world, all over the globe. It's not just us. The struggles against the WTO and the corporate powers that be did not start in Seattle in 1999, you know. More and more I notice these memes, you know, these, like, because I'll think something and then somebody else will say, oh, I was just thinking that, you know, or, you know, and I know that that's how it's working. Asking if the phrase or the term the commons means anything to you. Does it register?
No.
No. For you?
No, I guess not.
What about this space that we're sitting in?
Nice. It's very nice.
Pioneer Square.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
My other question is, what about the phrase common sense?
Yeah, I've heard that. Sure. I mean, it's good old horse sense, you know. Common sense means just exactly what it says.
Well, I think don't do nothing foolish and disrespect everybody else's, you know, whereabouts. And I think that's pretty decent, you know.
Yeah.
Use good judgment.
Do you think that people exercise common sense these days?
No.
How about you?
Maybe 50-50.
50-50?
Yeah,
okay.
But it can be used more and everybody can get along real good, you know.
Do you think people used to, there used to be more common sense than there is today?
I don't know. You know, the population has grown so much that I just wonder if that has a lot to do with it. You know, we've got more people now, and everything is on the media, and you just hear more. So I don't know that it is any less common sense.
Right.
It's just that we know it more.
We know more foolishness?
Yeah, foolishness, yes. Uh-huh.
We hear about that foolishness. And I'm wondering about, what about in our, like, government institutions or corporate institutions? Do you think that they exercise common sense?
Not necessarily.
Right.
I don't think so, at all. I think they're stupid.
Hi, I'm with KBOO Community Radio.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm asking people today a couple of questions. I'm asking them if the phrase, the commons, registers with you, if it means anything to you.
Mm-mm.
No? And what about the phrase common sense?
Common sense, logic, sure.
So common sense is logic?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you think that we have common sense in the world today?
Sometimes I think our parents in this day and age aren't very good role models to their children in that way.
Like, do you think that there was a time that there was a more common sense?
I do. I think that there was a time when honesty and integrity was a piece around common sense, mm-hmm. and that our parents role modeled that for us. I don't exactly know why it's different today, but I see a lot of parents sort of trying to cheat the system, if you will, and our children think that's okay.
Now, what do you mean by cheat the system?
Maybe lie or sort of go about it in the back door, through the back door, in the not the most honest and not the most integrous way.
Who's modeling that behavior?
I think, well, of course, our government logic, sure.
Common sense.
So common sense. Yeah.
A chick, do you think
that we sense in the world today?
Common sense. Sense in
very good role model.
Very good role model.
Way.
That. Do you think
there, you know, these kinds of things, and the lack of control over those as common folk, and a lack of common sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think I totally agree with you.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
On the farm, we don't
allowing us, and the corporations aren't allowing us to have clean air, first of all, clean water. Bechtel went to Bolivia, decided to privatize the whole water, made people pay for the water that they collected on their roofs with buckets.
Corporations, which are now multinational, they need the poor and they need their resources, and it's become like a commodity. Love to call myself a conservative, but these conservatives are hiding behind that word. They're hiding behind the cloth of Christianity. And if you look at their whole mentality, their whole goals is the world's going to end.
I see every single person in the comments because everybody's going to be affected by the cancer, growing cancer rate. Right? Everybody's going to be affected by depleted uranium bullets and all that kind of stuff.
Does the term the commons mean anything to you?
Of course it does. The commons is where people can gather and express whatever they need, from sharing food to exchanging political thought to finding housing for people who need housing, for just sharing all of the wealth that we have.
Does the term common sense mean anything?
It means a lot to me. Whether it means anything to our society, I don't know anymore. I think we have it in our heart and spirits. I don't think we have it in our community, or certainly not in our government or in our institutions anymore. We've lost common sense. Even though if you asked any of them, they'd probably say that they are the leaders of common sense. You know, corporations have personhood. Corporations are people. I mean, many things I'd like to see happen in our lifetime, but one of them is that corporations lose all other personhood so they can be held accountable for anything we want to hold them accountable for, from environmental degradation to labor practices to greed to corruption. Our government now makes totally corrupt laws. It is really these weekend peace rallies and these kind of rallies against this corrupt World Trade Organization where people come out. It's like, even though I think this is a wonderful thing as far as us taking the commons and practicing common sense, I think it's a pretty small effort. And I think it's going to take basically, I think that the corporate and the political institutions are so powerfully strong right now that we got to break them, and I think it's going to collapse before we can rebuild the commons, because then those with the heart and soul will find the commons once again.
Eventually people will realize that the whole planet is a common.
Oh,
thank you to Cherie Blackfeather, Peter Toby, and Ricky for the KABU report. It's almost 9:30. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, Chris Andre will be interviewing Eric Huffschmid from Goleta, California, on 9/11, Truth versus Fiction.
Good morning. This is the KBOO Friday Morning Radio Zine. It is 9:30. I'm Chris Andre, and my guest this morning is Eric Huffschmid, a prominent 9/11 investigator. He wrote a wonderful book, which I highly recommend. It's called Painful Questions. It is an absolutely stunning revelation what actually happened, or at least there are no answers to the painful questions in the book, but it raises is really quite alarming. And we're going to talk with Eric Huffschmid in just a moment, and he'll say a little bit about some of the questions that his book raises and some of the more likely explanations of what happened. And what we'd like to talk about this morning when we open the lines, we'll take callers. Please call us. This is a half-hour show, so please do keep your remarks very brief. If somehow you accidentally get carried away, we will have to regrettably cut you off. So do please keep your remarks brief and think about some of the implications that when we consider 9/11 and so many unanswered problems with the official explanation, how that ties in with the concept of permanent war. This week has really been quite a big week for the news. If you're following things and not caught up in the Christmas madness, then you should be, by this time, seriously alarmed. And the concept of permanent war is moving inexorably from being a concept to a reality. And now, do we have Eric on the line? Good morning, Eric.
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you very much for joining us. Your book, Painful Questions, is, I think, the most important document on 9/11, far surpassing, of course, the official account and some of the other speculation. The questions that it raises are truly historic. And what we were going to talk about this morning a little bit is, I thought perhaps, some of the relationships between your look and other investigators' looks at 9/11 and how that relates to the concept of permanent war and how we seem to be moving in that direction. Could you talk a little bit first about the book, Painful Questions?
Well, yes, the reason it has a lot of effect on people is because it has a lot of big color photos of what actually happened that day, photos that most people have never seen, such as how those towers actually fell down. And I have diagrams in it to explain that the fires in the towers were not even very large. See, a lot of people have the impression that inside those towers were these monstrous fires that were practically melting steel. They don't realize that if you look closely at all the photos, those fires were small. They weren't even spreading from one side of the building to the other in the South Tower. And there are reports that just came out recently that the firemen had been walking around up there. They finally made it up to the South Tower and the North Tower fire zone, and they're walking around up there sending back reports. So the fire wasn't even hot enough to keep the firemen out. I mean, so it's a sign that, you know, these fires were small. And then if you look at how the South Tower came down, the entire top portion broke, tipped over, and started falling to the ground. You look through the rubble. See, it's these photos in my book that are really what's affecting people. And this is the reason you don't hear people talking about it. You know, you see this book, it changes your mind about what really happened that day.
One of the oddest things that I've come across in my own research, and certainly since we talked in Santa Barbara around Thanksgiving, I believe, is there is a huge gulf of awareness between people that look at these pictures and look at the evidence and, you know, read varying reports, generally from other countries, not this one, between the people who are not satisfied with the official answers and the people who are perfectly happy not to look at it. There are a great many very respectable writers who are progressive, and Howard Zinn, to name just one, people who just will not look at this evidence, or if they will, they seem to have nothing to say about it. How do you explain that silence?
Oh, I don't know. There's you could almost divide people up into several groups. You got the majority of people who just don't want to deal with it. I think it upsets them too much. They'll look at these photographs and it makes them silent, like you mentioned, because they can't explain it. Like on the photo on page 27, there's a woman standing in the hole created by the airplane, and this is supposed to be a fire that's capable of bringing a building down, and here's a woman walking around. I mean, most people look at this stuff, and it upsets them so much that their attitude is to hide from it. It reminds me of children, you know, when they're scared, they run and hide behind their mother's leg, you know, peek out from behind her leg. That's what most people are like. You know, when they see crime, they run.
Yeah, I'm just though still astonished that there are many people on the left, very progressive of thinkers, writers, commentators, and they're used to being alarmed.
Well, this is the problem. You see, they've created this impression that there's this left group and a right group, and each group is, they fight with each other. Each one thinks they're superior. But if you look at both sides, I mean, the corruption's everywhere, both Democrats, Republicans, whatever you want to call them, liberals, conservatives. And this, what you don't want to get caught in is this trap that one side is somehow better than the other. Because it's not true. If you look at these so-called liberals, I mean, how many of them are exposing any of this corruption? And it's not. And 9/11 is just one of many of these things. You know, and what it seems like they're trying to do is they encourage this fighting, because as long as you're fighting with each other, you don't notice that the corruption is going on. You know, if they can get men and women to fight, whites and blacks to fight, Democrats and Republicans to fight. By keeping everybody fighting, the nation is not at all united. There's no, you know, the people are not even noticing that the government's being taken control of. The media is lying to us. And so you don't want to get trapped into this thinking, you know, why is the left not talking? Well, the left is just as corrupt. It's just in a different manner.
Yes, I can certainly see that. In a moment, we will take a few calls from people. Tell us, though, a little bit more about, with regard to the two towers, World Trade Center, and then, of course, Building 7, why the official silence over the destruction of WTC-7.
Oh, they have to keep this one very, very quiet because they have no way to explain it. Building 7, and here's another big problem. Most people don't even know what it is. They still, you know, except for a few radio stations such as yours, most people don't know what it is. It's a 47-story building, a steel-framed building, not wood, not concrete, steel-framed building. 5:30 in the evening, the entire building just crumbles into a pile of rubble. And there's no way to explain it. Absolutely no way. If you look at the photos or the video of how this building came down, the government, what the government has done in one of their reports, the FEMA report, is they said they don't know why it came down. The 9/11 Commission report didn't even mention the building. They decided there's no way to explain it, so they don't even mention it. And they're hoping, by not mentioning it, that people don't notice it. Because the only way to explain it is explosives. People put explosives in these buildings before the attack, and then when they felt they were ready, they just pushed the button and it brought the buildings down.
Well, Larry Silverstein, it is reported that Larry Silverstein told the fire chief that there was that at the end of the day that they ought to just take
Oh, right.
Down. But even if, let's say, that they decided to do that. And so definitely it's going to be a controlled demolition. That takes a little bit of time to set up, does it not?
Oh, it would take quite a bit because you have to know the plans for the building. You have to know where how the frame is built. You have to then have access to the building so that you can put the explosives in there. And there's no way they could have done that in a few hours, especially considering that the traffic jam was making it impossible to even deliver explosives and people. See, his remark cannot be taken seriously. His remark is a sign that there is something seriously wrong here. But nobody asked him anything. Nobody investigated what he said. Nobody investigated him or the fire department and asked, what's going on around here?
So he didn't testify before the 9/11 commission?
Well, if he did, he was on their side, and he only told them what they said. I mean, if he was at all talked to by anybody. Mostly what is happening is that the commission, because I know the commission interviewed Willie Rodriguez, and he says nothing he said even went into the report. And he was one of the people that was pushing for that commission report in the first place, and they interviewed him, but they wouldn't put anything in, because what he has to say contradicts everything. You know, he was hearing explosives going off, for example.
Yeah.
And he saw the person down in the basement with his skin blown off his arm. You can't explain that. You know, an airplane hits the top of the building and a guy in the basement gets his skin blown off. It doesn't make any sense. And so what they did is they had to ignore him completely. And they have to ignore Building 7 completely. And they're hoping that by keeping people ignorant, that they don't realize this. There is something seriously wrong with that attack.
Yeah. Hey, I wonder if do we have any callers on the line? No, we don't. We have no callers yet. That surprises me a little bit because we've talked about some of these issues before, and usually we get a lot of people who are interested in participating. But at least that gives me a chance to ask you about the debris. When I look at some of the photographs in Painful Questions, it appears that buildings were absolutely shredded. Concrete was reduced to dust, and steel beams were fragmented, and I don't see how a fire could do that. There was recently, actually, a fire in a building in Tehran, I believe. Yes, it was in Tehran. A plane flew into a building. This was an accident, this one. And the building, the photographs, the building looked pretty much okay, and I figured that buildings possibly in Tehran would not be as well constructed as these. At any rate, we do have a caller. So, yes, good morning, caller. You're on the air with Eric Hartschmidt.
Hi, this is Dave.
Hi.
I have a problem with jumping to conclusions about why these buildings came down, discounting the fires in the building, based on, as far as I can tell, from common sense. This is the writer. I'm sorry, I had your name when I turned my radio on. But I was wondering if you had more of a what your background is for your analysis of this, you know, bucking nationally renowned structural engineers.
Well, this is another good one. People will say, because I developed computer software for the CAD-CAM industry, they'll say, well, he doesn't have the qualifications. We recently had a physics professor at Brigham Young University look into it in his class, and they are all coming to the same conclusion also. And you've got other people doing it. It's not the background. You can't. What people have to do is look at the photos, look at the evidence, and it starts becoming obvious. You can't discount this information by saying, well, I do computer software, so therefore I can't know, because there are more and more people around the world looking into this, and they're all coming to the same conclusion, and they're all different.
I agree with that. They're all coming to the same conclusion.
I mean, we got a physics professor looking into it, too, and one of the things he looked into was one of the things I say on my video.
Well,
you can see the video.
A physics professor is not an engineer.
Huh?
A physics professor is not an engineer.
That's right. And there are, but see, this is what people will say no matter who comes forward. They'll say, well, he's an engineer, but he doesn't know physics. Or he's an engineer, but he doesn't know chemistry. This is the argument people are trying to use. What the physics professor shows is what I have in my video at hugequestions.com. These buildings came, the North Tower and South Tower, the entire structure disintegrated in 8.4 seconds for the North Tower and about 9 seconds for the South Tower. And he's pointing out what I point out. He verifies it. You cannot have a building that size break apart in that amount of time.
It came down because the top floors collapsed, and that collapsed.
And how do you know this?
I was there. I was in New York. I was living in Brooklyn at the time. I walked.
But that doesn't prove anything. Just because you're there.
Straight down. It's like what people say were puffs of smoke. Like I've read a lot of the revisionist history here. People think
they didn't come straight down. Look, they did not come straight down. Look at page 46 of my book.
Things. Those were the windows blowing out from the pressure of the falling floors, each floor collapsing the lower ones in turn.
But that's characteristic of a controlled demolition also. I'd just like to mention
That is true, and that's what people have been pointing to, is to say, like, oh, there were explosive charges in the building.
But you're wrong when you say they came straight down. But look at page 46 of my book, page 44 and page 45. Page 50, you can see the top of the South Tower has broken off and is falling over. Well, this is what I'm saying. You don't know what's going on. You haven't looked at the photos.
The first to collapse, of course. But
No, not of course. What is this of course business? Look, why don't you put your name on an article, put it out there, and we'll look at what you have to say. You have not seen the photos?
Because I think you and people like you are reducing the credibility of...
Well, I think what you are doing, you are a paid person to cover this up. This has been going on for years. Look at the photographs. People should not listen.
I'm a commercial photographer. I was working at Nickelodeon as an animator in New York. Why?
And you know more than I do? Because you're an animator?
No, I'm just saying it's obvious that... Okay, look, what people...
You said I was not an engineer. You said the physics professor is not an engineer.
I'm not saying my opinion is more valid than yours. I'm just saying yours is based on...
My opinion is based on... No, it's photos, seismic data. We have physics professors. This is what people have to watch out for. The pressure.
Are really tarnishing the name of progressives and people who are against the idea of total war of this interminable war, because you're saying that, like, somehow this was engineered. This whole event was engineered. It was not engineered. It was taken advantage of and used as a rationale.
Now, how do you know that?
Oh, one moment, caller, please. I think we have other callers on the line, and I wonder
if you could conclude your
remarks, and we'll take another call.
I just think that you're backwards. They're fighting. You know, in terms of public opinion, people like you make the progressive movement look bad. Thank you.
Do we have another caller on the line? Good morning, caller.
Good morning. I just have a simple question. I'm just wondering what the website address for looking at some of this evidence that your guest is talking about is, and I'll take my answer off the air.
You can watch videos for free at hugequestions.com. The word huge, H-U-G-E, and then questions.com, and it will even lead you to some other ones. It's all there for free. Just watch it yourself. And this is what people have to realize. They've got to look at the evidence. Don't listen to emotional manipulation, these remarks about, oh, well, he's not an engineer. That means nothing. Look at the evidence.
And thanks very much, caller. I think we have someone else who would like to participate, too. Good morning, caller. You're on the air. Are you there, caller? We'll have the next person in.
Oh, I can hear him. Is it?
Hello? Guess we don't have anyone at the moment. Talk a little bit about, if you would, about the debris.
Yeah, actually, I could hear that caller. I guess you can't hear, but...
No, I suppose we're still trying to get you on the air, caller, so do be patient. And
he's actually on it. He's talking right now.
Well, he's not on the air here.
Something's wrong. You better cut him off because he's talking right now.
Oh. Okay, we can do that. About the debris at the base of the... Well, we do have a caller now, so excuse me. But yes, go ahead. Caller, you are on the air.
I would like the title of the book, please.
Oh, it's Painful Questions by Eric Hufschmidt.
Oh, thank you very, very much.
And I highly recommend it. I've read it several times. And what you really want to look at is the raw data, the photographs and raw data. Researchers, structural engineers, reports from structural engineers are cited in the book, and there's just an overwhelming amount of evidence. Did you have any other remarks?
No, I just want to say thanks for. I don't want to thank him for hanging in with that guy that came in just before I did, hanging in and dealing with him. It was good, very good. Very well done. Thank you very much.
Great. Do we have another caller yet? I'd like to hear more about the debris. That's something that interests me. It looks like the building was shredded.
And not only that, but if you listen to the video from the firemen, what they all make remarks about is how they didn't find anything from the building. They're talking about the telephones even being shredded. The computers were shredded. Now, you've got to picture this. A building is falling down, and you don't find anything crushed. You don't find any crushed computers. You don't find any crushed office furniture. Everything is blown apart into pieces. And see, this is, again, a sign. This is not just a building falling down at all. This is a building with powerful explosives that are just ripping things apart. And this explains why there are so many health problems over there in New York today. Some of the firemen have recently died because of this. They were breathing what people call dust. You know those clouds, they call it dust. It wasn't dust. It was demolition debris. It was pulverized windows, pulverized computers, pulverized fluorescent light bulbs. These people were breathing it, getting it in their eyes, getting it in their nose. There were skin rashes. There are people suffering from respiratory problems because of it. It was extremely dangerous stuff.
Do we have a caller on the line? I think we do. Yes, we do. Yes, good morning, caller.
Good morning. Yeah, dealing with the question of the controlled demolition that would have been required to produce the energy required to bring down the building at free fall speed, which basically it did. I was wondering if you did any investigation in your book that would expand upon the work that was done in Dr. Griffin's book, The New Pearl Harbor, on the subject of Neil Bush, George Bush's brother, having the security contract for the World Trade Center and the number of fire alarms and times that the power was cut and people were ushered out of the building in the months prior to September 11th, 2001.
Well, no, I didn't. My book actually came out before Griffin's book, and in fact, Griffin is referencing mine as evidence for the demolition. So he probably has some of the newer information. As far as things like the connection between the Bushes and the security being turned off, see, that's getting into how they did it. And I didn't really get into how they did it. What I'm trying to do is just show the evidence that the buildings were demolished rather than trying to explain who did it and why. There is evidence that, there are people saying, in my video, you can see on the internet at hugequestions.com that I mentioned that Larry Silverstein has been reported after he got control of the two towers, after he became landlord for 99 years, he got control of the two towers and then he started changing the security and maintenance personnel. So that gave him control over this. There may have been some Bush involvement also. But you see, nobody's looking into any of these suspicious aspects. There are reports also, like you said, the power was turned off sometimes, supposedly for security, for maintenance reasons. This was giving them the opportunity to install the explosives, you see.
And what about the question of the Israeli art dealers,
right?
That's
a subject almost nobody will talk about. The only radio show I know of that will even touch this is Daryl Bradford Smith at the Genesis Network. There were 120 or more art students. An Israeli newspaper was saying 100, more than 120. Some newspapers say more, like 200. They were picked up, arrested, but then sent back to Israel without really any questioning. There were five Israelis picked up after they were caught dancing around, filming the incident. They were reported to have Arab clothing in their car. So apparently what it was is they were dancing around as dressed as Arabs. Are you still there?
I think we lost the caller.
Oh, the caller. Well, anyway, the five dancing Israelis, they were later caught. They had Arab clothing in the car. So what it looks like they were trying to do was look like Arabs, and then they accidentally got caught by the police and quietly sent back to Israel.
Some of the human actions and motivations are difficult to...
That's why I don't get into that,
Right, it's just the raw data. I think we do have... we've got one more call. We've got time for one more caller. Caller, please make your remarks brief. Go ahead.
One real quick remark. I'm glad you have this on. One, the physics proves, just if you would just do the physics of the amount of force required to create that much dust, it would take over 200 plane loads The physics is unrefutable, and people don't even need to see the question. I've come around to it from another approach, though, that gives people a sense, a feeling of what it is. Take a can of gasoline out to the railroad track and do whatever you can to try to soften those railroad ties, the rails. You can't do it. This gives people a first-hand sense that the fire is not hot enough to melt the steel. The steel of a railroad track is the same size as the steel in those buildings. If you take, I don't care how big your can of gasoline is, you cannot burn gasoline on the railroad track and make those rails soft, because gas fire does not have enough temperature to soften steel.
Well, yeah.
And jet fuel is less than gas. But just this visual image of someone with a can of gas going out to the railroad tracks makes it, it brings it home to people that they can feel, and they can try it if they want.
Well, they can do it on a kitchen stove if they have natural gas or butane or a...
And then they have the gut feeling, and they don't need the pictures, and they don't need the physics.
Well, the pictures and the physics help. I mean, there's people that will not buy
it. It helps some people. It helps some people.
Well, yeah, some people really don't know much about this.
That's right. And people need to have a visceral sense of how hot gas is. Not all fires are the same temperature. That's a physics thing, and people just the blinders go on when you talk physics. But if you hand them a can of gasoline and a match and point them at the railroad tracks,
you don't really want to tell people to go to the railroad tracks and start lighting fires.
Actually, I thought it might start stirring up the controversy and people questioning it. But you're right. No, I'm not encouraging any.
And that's all we need is people to do that and say, well, I heard it on the radio.
We'd just like to mention to listeners, please don't go out to the railroad tracks today.
No, but if you want to know how the relationship between fire,
in no way advocate that you try this at home.
But the pictures, the pictures will show people things they never saw. Like the picture on page 23 shows the size of these beams. Most people have no idea. When you're saying how thick the steel is, 4-inch thick in some places.
Yeah.
It's mind-blowing.
I understand. And it did it for me. I completely understood, but my background is in architecture and structural engineering.
You already know some of this.
Yeah, but it's the person at home. It's kids. It's 18-year-old kids. They don't understand. Give them a can of gasoline and tell them that they'll never be able to melt the steel on the railroad tracks, and then they get it.
Yeah, but you don't want people to try that. I mean,
no,
you can see on your kitchen stove,
I just want it in terms that they understand.
Oh, I know what you mean. That's why I explain that in the book about temperature. People don't know the difference between temperature and heat. They don't understand a lot of this. That's why I explain it. That's why the book is useful. That's why it's affecting people.
That's right. Hugequestions.com. Glad you're on.
Thanks very much, caller. Eric Hufschmidt, thank you so much for joining us today. This is a topic that people here in Portland anyway, and hopefully around the country, are very, very concerned about. And it is very important that we all avail ourselves of information that could change the way that we think. The book is Painful Questions by Eric Hufschmidt, and the website is Huge Questions, is it?
Yes, Huge Questions.
Yeah.
There are many.
I just like to add, too, that there are many, many websites, and this book and Eric Hufschmidt's DVD are available. There are many, many websites. It surprises me that callers feel that it's difficult to find this information. I found it very easy.
Oh, well, you knew where to look, but they're correct. If you look on the Internet for 9/11, you will find almost none of the so-called 9/11 truth seekers mentioning my book or video. This is how they're doing it. They're burying the truth with their own websites.
Actually, 9/11 Truth is another good website. It's a clearinghouse for a lot of this kind of information. Eric Hufschmidt, I thank you very much for joining us. I hope that you can join us again.
Well, yeah, sure. Just tell the listeners to start calling in and demanding more of this stuff.
Oh, we don't even have to encourage them.
Oh.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye.
Good day. This is KBOO Radio. It is 9:58 a.m. on Friday, December 23rd. I'm Chris Andre. My guest has been Eric Hufschmidt.
And you're listening to KBOO Portland, the Friday radio zine. Coming up next, Per Fagrand hosts a show on Syria, Lebanon, and the recent assassination.